gentlemen. We take the last two cases on the calendar, United States v. Goss. Counsel.
May it please the Court. My name is Mark Meyer. I represent the appellant, Leslie Dean Goss. Mr. Goss is here appealing the District Court's denial of his Rule 29 motion at the conclusion of the government's case and the prosecution for carjacking. Mr. Goss contends the evidence presented at trial was insufficient to sustain his carjacking conviction. Mr. Goss concedes that while the conduct would have constituted an assault under Montana law, it doesn't meet the intent requirements for the federal prosecution of carjacking. Just a brief recap of the factual situation. The prosecution is predicated upon some events that occurred on December 3rd, 2005 in the parking lot of the Lido Bar in Great Falls, Montana. Shortly before 2 o'clock in the morning, shortly before closing time, Ronald Paulson left the Lido Bar, got into his pickup truck, and drove a short distance into the parking lot of the Lido Bar, where he was and stopped his vehicle. Shortly thereafter, a van operated by Don Cannell drove into the bar's parking lot, and Leslie Dean Goss and his nephew Shane Goss, both of whom were intoxicated, exited the van and attempted to gain entrance into the Lido Bar. The incident was captured by the surveillance videotape from the bar. Reflects that Leslie Goss and Shane Goss were denied entry into the bar as the bar was closing. They stagger back towards the van. Leslie Goss staggers up into the parking lot where a confrontation ensues with Ronald Paulson, who was in his truck in the parking lot. Mr. Paulson testified that as he was opening his truck door to speak to Mr. Goss reached in, grabbed him, pulled him out while his truck was still engaged in gear. The truck began rolling through the parking lot out into the street, and it's beyond dispute that Shane Goss ran, jumped into the truck, and stopped the truck. Mr. Goss, his confrontation with Ronald Paulson, by Mr. Paulson's admission, lasted about 15 seconds. Leslie Goss left Ron Paulson, got up, ran to the truck, and both Shane Goss and Leslie Goss drove off with Mr. Paulson's vehicle.
But he did pull him out of the truck and he hit him.
Yes, yes, he did. It's our position that, based on the United States Supreme Court's decision in Holloway regarding the mens rea for the carjacking offense, that wasn't satisfied under the facts of this case. As you know, the Holloway court requires the focus be on the defendant's state of mind at the precise moment he demanded or took control over the vehicle. And that while we can see Mr. Goss clearly intended to assault Ron Paulson, he did neither his intent nor the force he employed was in furtherance to the subsequent taking of Mr. Paulson's vehicle. That the force, while it was employed to harm Mr. Paulson, wasn't employed to take his vehicle, and therefore it doesn't give rise to sufficient evidence to sustain the conviction under the carjacking statute.
But isn't the standard that we have to view all the evidence in the light most favorable to the prosecution and at the appellate level here? You've got your client pulling Mr. Paulson from the vehicle, repeatedly hitting him, and then going into the truck. Why did he pull him out of the truck? If you look at the facts in most favorable light to the prosecution, Perry wanted him out of the truck, and he wanted to get in the car, in the truck, rather, which he did.
I guess it's the contemporaneous nature of the assault versus the subsequent with the vehicle leaving the scene and Mr. Goss getting in the vehicle then, as well as the factual issue. At trial, there wasn't definitive. There was an issue as to who drove the truck away from the bar.
Did that even really matter? I mean, the reality is you have a videotape of this. It's a little unusual, but you have a videotape. The trier of fact saw the videotape, formed conclusions, and in our situation, we review in the light most favorable to the prosecution. How do you overcome that, counsel, on this particular point?
I guess I'd point the court to the Applewhite decision and say just the fact that those decisions that followed Holloway, subsequent to Holloway, regarding carjacking convictions, focus on the threat that was made by the defendant at the precise instance the vehicle was taken, pointing a gun to the driver's head, demanding control of the vehicle.
You're saying that there are other cases that are clearer. What case says that this doesn't constitute intent, that it couldn't be intent?
Cited in our brief, we focus on the United States versus Applewhite decision, where it was beyond dispute, defendant assaulted the victim with a baseball bat, placed him into the victim's vehicle, and drove off, and was subsequently charged, among other things, with carjacking. And the Third Circuit acknowledged that there was sufficient evidence to support the defendant's intent to kill or harm the victim, but noted that unless the threatened or actual force is employed in furtherance of the taking of the car, there's no carjacking within the meaning of 18 U.S.C. 2119.
But in this case, though, your client repeatedly hit Mr. Paulson, so there was threat or force involved.
There was an assault, yes.
So there's a difference from that other case, is there not? In that case, they just pulled him out. There was no striking, no force being used.
In Applewhite?
Yes.
Yes. No, there was force. They assaulted him with a baseball bat, hit him over the head, knocked him unconscious, and then placed him in
Applewhite,
victim's car.
Is that cited in the brief?
Applewhite, 195 F3rd 679.
Is it in the brief?
It's cited in my reply brief, John.
Your reply brief.
I think I have that either. Doesn't make a lot of sense, counsel.
And also, under the facts of this case, there is an assault in the parking lot. Leslie Gold is granted assaulting Ron Paulson. And the vehicle leaves, and Shane Goss, the individual who takes control of the vehicle, and from the defense point of view, drives the vehicle away from the scene of the assault.
Your client got in the vehicle, did he not?
Pardon?
Your client got in the vehicle.
Yes.
Did he drive it?
His position at trial was that it was Shane Goss that drove the vehicle.
Didn't he push him over and take over the wheel?
No.
He did not?
No. The surveillance video does reflect someone running around the front of the vehicle and entering the passenger side of the vehicle, but it's not definitive as to which individual that was.
Okay, I mean, I think we understand your point. I mean, it's very hard to imagine how you would ever get a conviction under the carjacking statute under your theory, other than saying to the person, by the way, the reason I'm assaulting you is not because I don't like you.
I guess I'd point the court to the other decisions cited in my brief, the United States versus
Well, they looked at the Applewhite one, you see, and they said the reason there was clear. They wanted to kill the man for clearly other reasons. The taking the car was incidental to it. Because they wanted to kill the female defendant's former husband, and taking the car was incidental, not the assault was, because they were trying to kill him, not to get his car. Here, they pulled him out of the van, beat him up, and took his car. What else could be clearer?
Well, here you have an intoxicated individual, and there's Mr. Paulson's testimony that he began a conversation.
So you're saying that he couldn't form the intent because he was
That was one of the arguments raised
at trial.
And that was
presented to the jury, and the jury rejected.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so where are we? You've had your time on this point. Do you have others?
Okay. Other than the next argument we raised, Your Honor, is the sentence imposed by the district court. Mr. Goss was sentenced to 180 months imprisonment. We've argued that that sentence was unreasonable in light of the fact...
Let me ask you one question. The judge would trade him to the Thompson criminal. And you look at the record, as you say, all of the offenses occurred 10 years earlier, so the major offense was much younger. But then if you look at the record, he seems to have been in prison all the intervening time. And whenever he got out, he then again committed the offense. Is that an inaccurate impression I have from reading the record?
No, that's accurate, Your Honor. There was a period of three offenses to be prosecuted in state court, four, and was incarcerated. The argument on the unreasonable sentence goes back. He received a sentence of 180 months. Subsequent to his conviction, the United States charged Shane Goss, the other individual, with assisting Mr. Goss in carjacking with the intent to hinder or prevent his apprehension. And he ultimately received an 18-month sentence. The reasonableness argument, the disparity in the sentences imposed.
Did Shane Goss have the same kind of criminal record?
No. No, Your Honor.
Well, your client was sentenced to career criminal?
Yes, he was, Your Honor.
I mean, the other Goss was younger?
Yes, it was his nephew.
What's surprising about the younger one without a record getting a much lighter sentence than the older one who was a career criminal?
Given the factual issue that existed as to who won, the fact that Shane Goss took control of the vehicle initially, and from the defense point of view, took control, remained in control, and drove the vehicle away from the bar on the evening in question.
Well, that's back to the earlier question.
Yeah, which do you think's worse? The one who pulls the man out of the car and beats him up, or the other guy who drives the car off with the guy who's the assailant?
Well, I guess our point would be the one who jumps in the vehicle and makes the decision to take the vehicle.
Well, that doesn't mean he made the decision because he jumped. He was the younger one, the nephew. His uncle is the guy with the long record to beat somebody up so that they can get a car. Why do you assume it's the younger one who made the decision?
I guess that would be if there was any evidence of any pre-plan to go to the bar and steal someone, to carjack someone, I would agree with you. But here, there's a random incident in the bar parking lot by two drunk individuals. Fight ensued, and Shane Goss was the one who took control of the vehicle at that time, and from the defense point of view, stayed in control of the vehicle throughout. We have an assault, to be sure, under state law, but it doesn't rise to the level of a federal offense of carjacking set out in the statute.
Okay. Thank you.
I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. My name is Joe Thagard. I'm an assistant United States attorney from Great Falls, Montana, and I prosecuted this matter. Addressing the first issue raised by the defendant, I would note that it's a common issue really in any criminal case as to how criminal intent is established. And it's typically inferred from the circumstances of the offense and the actions of the defendant. Certainly in this instance where this defendant went up to this car, pulled the man out, proceeded to beat him up, and then jumped into the vehicle once it was secured, that the jury, viewing the facts in the light most favorable to the government, infer the necessary criminal intent. I would also add that I don't think who initially seized the car.
You say that the jury viewed the facts in the light most favorable to the government?
No, I'm saying that at this point when the court is...
Oh, yeah, on review, of course, yeah. Right. But at the time the jury reviewed it, you had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the crime had been committed.
It would have made my job a lot easier if I had that standard.
Indeed.
I don't know that it would comport with the Constitution.
Right.
And certainly, I think with respect to who took control of this car, in a large sense, that's irrelevant. The jury... jury was instructed on an aiding and abetting theory here, and they certainly could have found a basis for culpability based on that. I would also note that with respect to the criminal intent issue, that the jury was instructed on intoxication. And again, they had an opportunity to view that and determine whether or not the level of intoxication would have prevented this defendant from forming the requisite intent, and they apparently rejected that. Finally, I turn my attention to Applewhite and Harris, which are the two principal cases cited by the defendant. I think those cases really are significantly distinguishable in this case in two respects.
Well, we talked about Applewhite already. I think that's really clear.
And Judge, now I'll just turn to Harris. And the critical issue in Harris, again, is like, as in Applewhite, the defendant testified. And there was another theory put forth, really in the absence of any sort of even circumstantial evidence from the government as to what was going on with the defendants in those two cases when they took possession of those cars. And again, Harris, like Applewhite, I think was essentially a murder case where the vehicle was taken as an afterthought. Unless the panel has any questions on the first issue, I'll turn to the issue of reasonableness. And I think that the panel basically hit the nail right on the head in addressing that. On one hand, we have the nephew who's believe was a 20-year-old kid with a minimal criminal record. On the other hand, there's the defendant in this matter, Mr. Goss, who had an extensive criminal history, criminal history that was so extensive, in fact, that he was a career offender. And based on that, any disparity in the sentencing.
Mr. Taggart, I believe you were in the courtroom when we had the colloquy with the counsel in the previous case.
Yes, Your Honor.
And I asked counsel at that point about their impression about whether we need to wait for Zavala-Carty, our case. As you know, Rita decided certain things, but apparently somebody died and the Supreme Court didn't get to the other part of the question. Do you think that we need to wait in this case to be able to know the standard upon which we are determining reasonableness, or by virtue of the fact that as circuit judges, we are given the instruction under the statute to determine whether the sentence is, in quotes, reasonable without much more guidance, can we decide it based on that alone?
And Judge, I'll confine my comments to this particular case.
Yeah, well, of course, yeah, that's what we're talking about.
I certainly don't want to speak to
you. You can write a law review article later if you want, but I think we're interested in this particular case.
Yeah, and Judge, with respect to this particular case, under this set of facts, I don't think it's necessary to wait. I think that this is...
Why should we not have to wait for our court to decide what the standard is?
And Judge, you certainly can.
No, I know we can. I'm interested in why you say... we don't have to. I'd like to know what the principle is or the rule is for when we can and when we can't.
And
you say in this particular case, it's got to be some reason.
Yeah, and what I'm referring to in particular is the absolutely horrendous criminal record that this man has. And the fact that he was in prison for an extensive period of time and it apparently had no effect.
What's the legal basis? You're saying if the case is so clear as to what the result is, that it doesn't matter what standard we adopt, under any standard, if we would find it reasonable under any standard, then we can decide it now.
Yes,
conversely, if we found something under any standard that's unreasonable, we can do it now.
Exactly, Your Honor. And I think in this particular case, there's one. Unless the panel has any other questions.
I want to follow up
sure.
on what we're talking about here. Based on our responsibility to review reasonableness, what is the standard that we review? We know Rita's take on that each circuit gets to decide whether it's presumptively reasonable if it's within the guidelines. But outside that context, reasonableness is a word. What does it mean for us? What are the bases, what are the criteria that we should be using in the Ninth Circuit to determine whether a sentence like this one is reasonable?
Well, I certainly think that you can start with reviewing that Rita rationale of Gary Lace, please, I think when you've got a district court judge and the sentencing guidelines essentially reaching the same conclusion about what is a reasonable...
Okay, so the district court judge went through 3553A.
Right.
Departed upward, I believe, in this case, modestly. Is that correct?
No, I don't believe so in this... Oh, no, you're right, Your Honor.
It was modest, but I think it was a slight departure upward. But eventually, however Zavala Cardi comes down, it's really a question of what the standard is that our circuit adopts. If we adopt the standard that the Supreme Court permits, which is that it is presumptively reasonable, then we still don't answer the question, what overcomes the presumption? I'm interested in what the government's take is on that. What should we be looking at? Why can't we, based upon our inherent power as circuit judges, make a determination now? But if we do that, what is the standard? What do we hold on to? Is it something that we decide based upon our sense of justice? Is it something that we decide based upon 3553A? And if we do that, is that something we ought to be doing, or is that something that the trial court ought to be doing, where the judge gets to see the demeanor of the witnesses and gets to do all the things that all of us know the trial judges have a better perspective on than we do based upon a dry record?
Well, I think, Judge, there may be a blend there. I think certainly you need to have the sort of minimal compliance with Booker. We need to have a consideration of 3553A. We have to have an accurate guideline calculation. But then I think at that point that we do need to recognize that there should be significant discretion with the lower court. That court is in a position to judge the credibility of these individuals. It certainly is going to need to make factual findings.
That's not really helpful as far as answering the question. The Congress could have said, or the Supreme Court, I guess, could have said, as long as they comply with the procedure. German, see if the district court complies with the procedure, whether it's fulfilled its obligation. They didn't say that. They said you can't see if the question of the sentence is reached.
Sure.
Of course you take into account all these things. District judges are very learned. They see people. They're very bright. They make wonderful judgments. But they still said you've got to determine whether it's reasonable. How do we know whether it's reasonable? I think we're asking what is possible. But,
well, it's...
Is it like a sentence? Do we know it when we see it? Is it unreasonable?
Well, I certainly hope that it becomes more clear than obscenity, Your Honor. However, really, other than the sorts of criteria that I've alluded to...
Suppose you were here saying a district judge imposed too low a sentence, which wouldn't be how that starts. How would you argue to a system what would make us know that it was unreasonable? What kind of fact?
Well, I think, first of all, I would look at whether the factual findings upon which the district court relied were clearly erroneous. I would look at whether there was an absolute misinterpretation of law in some sense. If the court simply missed one of the factors or totally misinterpreted it, I would look at that. I would look at countervailing evidence. I would look at whether there was a misunderstanding of the guidelines. Those are the sorts of things I would look at, Your Honor. Under those circumstances, under the individual circumstances of the case, that would be how I would present that sort of case. And that may not be very helpful.
And from your perspective, if we did that, then we could decide right now whether this case is reasonable.
I think so.
So if we go through and we look at the record and we say, well, this and that fact were wrong, as clearly shown by the record, that would be one of the criteria that you indicated might be the basis for determining the sentence was unreasonable. For example, and it doesn't really apply to this case, but arguing to say that this man... had in fact never gone to prison, but the judge said that he had. The record showed to the contrary. That would obviously be the kind of thing you're talking about, right?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that would be the sort of very clear, egregious kind of case.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
I won't be a dead horse, Your Honors, but wanted to reiterate as far as my main point on the carjacking conviction is the absence of a contemporaneous between the taking and the intent to harm Mr. Paulson. And that's...
In the case that you said, Harris and also the other case you said, that's another case where what they said was the reason the car was not connected with the other offense. It was they took the car to get away after they committed a murder. They didn't intend to
right, I think they focused in on the lack of any required connection in time between the taking of the vehicle and the offense itself. And contrasted to the decisions in LeBron, Cepeda, and Adams, where the defendant placed a gun to the driver's head, and that evidence permitted the inference the defendant would have used force to take vehicle and therefore satisfied the Holloway's requirement.
No, unlike the two cases you cited, there's no other independent crime with which taking the car was connected. The assault was not independent of taking the car.
From our point of view, it is, Your Honor. I guess we have the assault and then we have...
At most, that's a jury question. Why did they assault? Was it connected to the car? That's the proper question for jury. I mean, there's no evidence that the assault was committed for some other reason.
No. No, there's not, Your Honor. If there are no other questions with respect to the other issues, I'd rest on the arguments and answer my brief.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both very much. The case just argued will be submitted.